Cheers to my fellow sports fans out there. This is Kent Batty, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the USA Today Sports Weekly, bringing us the sports news of the week. Reading to you today from the USA Today Sports Weekly, dated June 11th through the 17th, 2025. And we'll start with the leading off column this week by Jarrett Bell. Drop the name of Aaron Rodgers to a couple of friendly strangers in the Steel City, and it doesn't matter that you've just met. Pass the truth serum. In these parts, where the fans bleed black and gold, it seems everybody has some passionate opinion about the new Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback. I was expecting this to happen, Corrine Farrell said, but I'm extremely disappointed with the Steelers organization. As Farrell broke down her reasoning with USA Today Sports on a plaza at PNC Park before the Pirates took on the Philadelphia Phillies on June 6th, she's skeptical of how Rodgers will impact locker room chemistry, wonders about the one-year commitment, and, among other concerns, didn't feel his anti-vax stance. Arianna Lauer sat behind her and provided background optics. Lauer flashed a thumb down and shook her head. "Steelers fans, we've been through the ringer," Lauer said. "I just want something to last. I want a Josh Allen." Taking the pulse from fans about Rodgers, 41, was quite the exercise during a rain delay that pushed back the first pitch. And it was apparent that for all the items on Rodgers' agenda, as he seeks to regain the form that allowed him to earn four NFL MVP awards, winning over the Steelers' rabid fan base is also a legitimate challenge. Master a new system, mesh with new teammates, adapt to a new city, shoot, convincing Steelers Nation he is the answer might be tougher than any of that. Of course, winning can change hearts and minds. And, well, winning big when considering a franchise that has never had a losing season in Mike Tomlin's 18-year tenure, but hasn't won a playoff game since 2016, well, there's no free pass. Never mind a grace period. Rodgers, whose one-year contract could pay $19.5 million with incentives and guarantees $10 million, according to ESPN, seemingly gets little, if any, grace from the fan base. My honest opinion, and I'm not happy about it, Ron Statler, another lifelong fan, declared, I wanted to see Mason Rudolph get a chance. He added, I have a lot of friends that feel the same way, too. And a son. He summoned Ron Statler Jr., standing a few feet away, and the 40-something son was a lot less diplomatic. No, not optimistic at all, Statler Jr. said. I wish he'd have retired already. He sucks. Say what? About a four-time NFL MVP? Look at his record the last 3 years, Statler Jr. shot back, and he's almost as old as me. Come on, Tomlin. Rodgers, set to participate in the Steelers minicamp that opens June 10th, joins a quarterback room that includes Rudolph, Skylar Thompson, and sixth-round rookie Will Howard. His 2 seasons with the New York Jets included a torn Achilles tendon that wiped out his 23 campaign after only 4 plays, and a meltdown in 2024 that extended way beyond the quarterbacking and included the early-season firing of coach Rob Saleh. The skepticism for another fresh start, though, maybe even worse when assessing reaction on social media since the much-anticipated news finally broke June 5th that Rodgers would join the Steelers for his 21st NFL season. Maybe the most extreme damnation came from a now-ex-Steelers fan who posted a video on social media that went viral. In the video, the man renounced his fan loyalty and burned a signed Minkah Fitzpatrick jersey. Sorry, Minkah. The jersey became a convenient prop. It's not like the 5-time Pro Bowl safety is making the personnel decisions. First off, why Minkah's jersey? That's bonkers, Cam Hayward, the veteran defensive tackle, said in a rebuttal post on X. Second, why burn it when there are plenty of people who could use clothes? Third, you're going to regret it. Leave it to Hayward, team captain and well-respected locker room presence, to lend a voice of reason. Still, from the jersey-burning guy to the handful of fans encountered at the baseball game, there's something to be drawn about the psyche of Steeler fans. As Tomlin is prone to state, the standard is the standard. For followers of a franchise that has won 6 Super Bowls, that means a championship standard, which is why the drought cuts so deeply. Last season's championship visions, with Russell Wilson supplanting Justin Fields at the stretch, unravels so fast, it's unbelievable. The Steelers went from 10-3 in mid-December to losing their final five games, including another first-round playoff knockout. Maybe Rodgers will be the difference maker at quarterback that Pittsburgh hasn't had since Ben Roethlisberger retired after the 21 season. After all, Tom Brady was 43 during the 2020 campaign when he led the Tampa Bay Buccaneers to a Super Bowl 55 crown. "I'm not going to hold my breath," Farrell said of the prospect of a deep playoff run. "I go into every season optimistic," she allowed. "I'm really hoping, although I don't like him, that maybe he changes things to the point that we can win more than nine games." Hey, optimism isn't extinct after all. Voices of positivity remain. You just have to dig a bit deeper these days to find it coming from a Steelers fan. "I'm really excited," maintained Austin Patton, another Steeler fan lifer. "No other quarterback on the roster is better. His experience is huge. Tom Brady did the same thing." He knows. His is not the popular opinion. "A lot of people hate, but every year I think they're going to the Super Bowl," Patton said. "Maybe there's a bit of delusion." Or, with Rodgers' arrival, just another reason to express some serious passion. Our next couple of stories will be from the world of Major League Baseball. The first one is headlined, "Cubs, Crow Armstrong, the Next Big Thing." And this is by Gabe Lax, columnist for USA Today. "This is a Chicago Cubs team like no other. There's no curse to bust. And besides, it's been nearly a decade since the star-studded 2016 edition captured the franchise's first World Series since 1908. Nor are there any glaring holes, ranging from laughable to mystifying, as so many Cub clubs before 16 embodied in that format. And the often penny-pitching editions since featured the latter. No, the team with the best record in the National League Central is, by both design and happenstance, solid and spectacular. Solid, as in it does many of the obscure yet crucial things so well, such as catching the ball, running the bases, making contact, and limiting damage. As for the spectacular, that's what Pete Crow Armstrong provides. The most valuable player in the National League, by whichever flavor of the WAR you prefer, has won games, stolen them at times, with every one of baseball's five tools, sometimes in stunning succession. The Cubs left Washington last week for Detroit with a series win in hand and a PCA play of the day for every Cubby diehard who came out to Nationals Park. One night, it was not his speed but rather the threat of it that froze a Washington defender and resulted in a game-changing misplay as he danced off third. The next, it was a gap-to-gap sprint and crash into the left field wall to haul in a fly ball and keep intact a perfect game by lefty starter Matthew Boyd. And June 5th, it was simply turning on a hanging curveball and drilling it 412 feet over the center field wall for a first-inning, two-run home run that sent the Cubs victoriously on their way out of town. With his ability to apply a dash of slug or a drop of speed right when the Cubs need it, Crow Armstrong is as much an artist on the field as his parents, both successful actors, are in their work. And in the context of his ball club, Crow Armstrong is part of a breathtaking mosaic the Cubs, now 40 and 25, have commissioned. It's funny because you hear it all the time. This team plays the game the right way. So many times, people have a hard time being able to define what the right way means, Dansby Swanson, now in his third year as the Cubs shortstop, tells USA Today Sports. "I feel like we just have a lot of good baseball players. And when you put a lot of good baseball players on a team together that have a hunger and drive to do things for more than themselves, it leads to good team baseball. Everyone's accountable for themselves. Guys are accountable with one another. We have good relationships with each other. We hang out together. We do things together. Really cherish being in this room together. All those things put into one turn out to truly lead to good results on the field. It is a club by turns sexy and workmanlike, acquiring slugger Kyle Tucker, who can become a free agent after this season, in a blockbuster deal with the Houston Astros, gave the Cubs one of the top five all-around players in the game. And his slugging ability has both lengthened the lineup and relieved the burden on those hitting around him. As the season creeps toward the halfway point, Crow Armstrong's 17 homers and 21 steals put him on track for a 40-40 season, and any feat of athleticism from a guy whose speed ranks in the 97th percentile in the majors can inspire Cub fans to send a PCA chant echoing through Wrigleyville. Yet, almost every other facet is simply part of a well-rounded, hardball diet. They rank third in the majors in stolen bases, and as of last weekend, were second with an 84.4 success rate. They were also third in the NL on bases taken or advancing on grounders, fly balls, and balls in the dirt. Crow Armstrong and second baseman Nico Horner ranked first and second respectively at their positions in outs above average. Left fielder Ian Happ, Swanson, Tucker, and Horner boast 7 career gold gloves among them. And in what can only be described as a sleight of hand in this modern hitting environment, the Cubs rank third in the majors with a .443 slugging percentage, yet just 20th in strikeouts, getting to significant punch without the punch-outs. It's a gently suffocating style of baseball, where an extra ball in play creates an extra out, an extra base taken produces another run, and then somebody runs into one and sends it over the ivy. "We do all the major things well," says Justin Turner, the Cubs' 40-year-old designated hitter and veteran of 9 playoff teams in Los Angeles. "But the little intangibles are, I think, even more off the charts. It's elite defense, especially up the middle. It's one of the best base-running teams I've been on as far as stealing bases and taking extra bases, putting pressure on the defense. And I feel like the offense is one of the more dynamic ones I've been part of, whether that's hitting homers, playing small ball, situational hitting, stealing bases. It doesn't mean it's going to happen every night, but it's a very well-rounded club." Yet, win or lose, the Cubs can count on something spectacular happening from number 4. Crow Armstrong cuts a unique figure among the finely tuned behemoths populating a big league clubhouse. Listed at 6 feet and 184 pounds, his frame doesn't suggest a 40-homer guy will soon emerge. Clad in a ski cap, sweatpants, and a shin protector, even as the pregame temperature nudges north of 80 degrees, he looks more like the SoCal native headed to the skate park rather than the indoor batting cage. Yet something happens when he hits the diamond. Everybody kind of knew, oh, it's Pete. He's going to be the next big thing. "And now you see it coming to fruition," says Cubs rookie right-hander Cade Horton, who frequently crossed paths with Crow Armstrong on the youth showcase circuit in high school. "He's just the ultimate competitor and has all the tools. It was a combination of the athletic ability and his fiery competitiveness. When you put those things together, it's a recipe for something good. Just watching him compete was really, really special." Success did not come overnight. The New York Mets drafted him 19th overall in 2020, then flipped him for Javi Baez. At 21, he made a 13-game debut in 2023, then produced just a .237 average and a .286 on-base percentage in 123 games last season. But defense will always keep you up. Crow Armstrong produced 2.3 wins against placement last season, despite his offensive struggles. And then, sometimes, it all comes together. "I think we unfairly put things on players at a young age nowadays, whether it's just hype, the affinity for the prospects and what's next and what's new, and it heightens expectations at a young age," says Swanson. "The coolest thing is, usually in that third year, you expect guys to really come out into their own, and he's obviously done that. I'm not surprised by anything he does. He's a phenomenally gifted talent. He's super competitive. He's very passionate, very, in a good way, hard on himself about wanting to be great at this game. Ask the right questions. I say this with a smirk on my face. Everything he does, I expect him to do. I always believed in his ability, and I'll never let him settle for anything less than that." For Crow Armstrong, the exploits come with a firmer base, literally and figuratively. He credits his power surge to using the ground better, as he says, to exploit his lower half. And he entered spring convicted, secure in his job, and that's made all the difference. "I just came in with a lot more comfort and confidence in myself, really. But I think the coolest part about that is what's been asked of me hasn't really changed," says Crow Armstrong. "No one's asked me to hit the homers and do all this stuff. but the freedom I've been granted, the space to go play every day, I think that's why we're seeing that. My goal and my job and what is asked of me is still just to go and play a good center field. Now I'll turn to Nightingale's notebook, which is Bob's Nightingale's summary of happenings around Major League Baseball. The Chicago White Sox lived a full season through the despair, embarrassment, and stigma that comes with being the worst team in the history of baseball. Now, less than a year later, here come the Colorado Rockies, who are threatening to obliterate the White Sox modern record of 121 losses. The Rockies, even after their first three-game sweep in 13 months over the Miami Marlins, had a 12-53 record at the press time and are on pace to go 30-132. So, good times on Chicago's south side, where that 2024 season could vanish into the night and be wiped from the record books. I hope they don't break the record, White Sox general manager Chris Getz tells USA Today Sports. I don't wish that upon anyone. I really don't. Come on, really? Not even with a chance to scrub your name from infamy? Not to be linked forever to the 1962 Mets? You'd hate to see it. You really would, Getz says. It's so grueling. You know how much it hurts, and don't wish it on anyone. That's not something that I think is good for anyone. You go around the White Sox clubhouse, and you hear the same sentiment from everyone still around from that horrific season. No one wants to see that, White Sox outfielder Andrew Benintendi says. You don't feel for guys while you're playing, but off the field you do. I know they're in pretty tough division, but there's still a lot of games left. I hope they don't lose that many games. I'm just glad it's not us again right now. It's not as if the White Sox suddenly are contenders with a 22-44 record, but they look like the 27 Yankees compared to these Rockies. The Rockies became the third quickest team to reach 50 losses, behind only the 1884 Kansas City Unions and the 1876 Cincinnati Red Stockings. They've already had four 8-game losing streaks. They've been swept 11 times and shut out 8 times. The Rockies are going so bad that it was pointed out on social media that golfer Scottie Scheffler's 3 PGA Tour victories from May 4th to June 1st equaled the Rockies' win total in that span. The Rockies, after their first series sweep in 57 tries, retaliated by saying their 3 victories in 72 hours were more than Scheffler's total for the week. Touché. We lost a lot of games last year, but we were in a ton of them too, says the White Sox first baseman Andrew Vaughn. We were in a lot of close games, a lot of run-won games, but losing those close games made it tough. The White Sox were 13-29 in one-run games last season, with 11 walk-off losses. They blew 56 leads last season, including 12 games in which they had at least a 3-run cushion. Last year, it seemed like everything that could go wrong did go wrong, Benintendi says. It got a whole lot worse when the White Sox dumped everyone they could at the trade deadline, going just 14-50 in the second half of the season with 7 victories combined in July and August. The Rockies, on the other hand, have been getting blown out on a regular basis. They've lost 15 games by at least 5 runs in the first 2-plus months, with 4 games by 10 or more runs. The Rockies have already been outscored by 198 runs entering this week. I don't know what's better, Getz said. You're getting teased that you might pull one off here, and then all of a sudden it's taken away from you. And then there's the games like the Rockies have had when you're down early with a fair amount of distance. Those aren't fun either. The Rockies, unlike the White Sox, really don't have any players besides infielder Ryan McMahon, who are expected to attract much trade interest. So the good news is that it's quite possible that they keep their team intact. The bad news is they play in the National League West with the Dodgers, the Padres, the Diamondbacks, and the Giants, and are already 26.5 games out of first place. So, as embarrassing as it may be, it provides the Rockies plenty of time to look in the mirror for a reality check. Sometimes when you're going through something like this, Getz says, it's an opportunity to learn more about your organization and where you need to take it. We took advantage of that last year. It allowed us to clear a runway to make decisions that we felt would help us in the future. My message to them is that although you're going to endure something that is not easy, there is light at the end of the tunnel. Take advantage of the situations where you identify areas that you really, truly need to improve and go ahead and attack it. The key, the White Sox will tell you, Rockies, when they see them on July 4th through 6th at Coors Field, is not to let the mounting losses become such a mental burden, leaving you defeated even before you step on the field. I know what they're going through. It's tough, says White Sox third baseman Miguel Vargas, who got the bad break of being traded from the Dodgers to the White Sox at last year's deadline. You're blessed to play in the big leagues. You put in the work. You try to win every day, and it just doesn't happen. It's such a tough game, but you can't let it get you down. Certainly, the Rockies didn't have any expectations of contending this year. Maybe they were hoping not to lose 100 games for the third consecutive season. Maybe they were hoping to at least be within 10 games of a wild card berth entering September. But it's not as if they were Atlanta or Baltimore with World Series aspirations and are suddenly in disbelief with their losing record. The biggest thing you have to remember is to stay focused on getting better each day, says Vaughn, who was recently demoted to Class AAA. You've got to make each day important. You have to work on something to improve each day and not let anything get in the way. That's the biggest thing. It's no different than for the manager and coaching staff, front office executives, ticket sales reps, reminding yourselves that as painful as those losses are now, it will make winning feel that much better. Small consolation in my view. There was a time when the Houston Astros were a laughingstock too, losing 106, 107, and 111 games three consecutive seasons from 2011 to 2013. But since 2017, they have reached the postseason eight consecutive years with two World Series titles and four pennants. Although we knew last year wasn't going to be a good season in regard to our record, Getz says, there were still opportunities to add players at the deadline or in areas to improve in the organization. So you take a step back and try to emotionally stay big picture focused. In doing so, it allows you to work through it and find the positives, even though they're not showing up on your major league club. But we were able to highlight some areas that we felt could help us long term, and I hope they've got situations like that as well. Who knows? Maybe one day, maybe years and years from now, the White Sox and Rockies can look at each other and remind themselves looking back that the pain they endured paved the way to future glory. Maybe they can even laugh about it, or maybe they'll never even talk about it. The big thing is, Vaughn says, to forget about it. It happened in the past. I don't think about it anymore. Really? Why would you want to? Moving on, paying it forward. Paul Olden, 71, the New York Yankees public address announcer, was moved when he read that former Major League player Eric Anthony discovered that former Dodgers great Willie Davis was his father. Olden reached out to Anthony last week, and the two talked for nearly 20 minutes as Olden got off the subway and walked into Yankee Stadium. He told Anthony that he had a present for him. Olden, who grew up in Los Angeles and was a huge fan of Davis, had one of Davis's broken bats from his historic 31-game hitting streak in 1969, which remains a Dodgers record. The bat had remained in an umbrella holder at Olden's home all of these years. Now it will have a new home. I've gotten a lot of enjoyment from owning that bat from a childhood hero, Olden says. Now it's time to pass it on to someone who needs it more than I do. Olden told Anthony his favorite memories about his father was sharing pictures and stories when they were together after Davis's retirement. It shows what kind of person Paul Olden is, Anthony said, to take care about wanting me to have that bat. Shows he's selfless. I appreciate very much Paul's generosity. I will keep and cherish that bat for the rest of my days. Olden, who's been with the Yankees since they moved to their new ballpark in 2009, came up as a radio reporter and then a broadcaster for the Yankees, Tampa Bay Rays, Los Angeles Angels, Cleveland Guardians, Philadelphia Eagles, the Los Angeles Rams, New York Jets, New Jersey Nets, and UCLA. He also was the PA announcer for 12 consecutive Super Bowls. He became famous for being the radio reporter who asked Dodger manager Tom Lasorda what he thought of Dave Kingman's performance. That is, when he hit three home runs against the Dodgers in 1978, launching into a profanity-laden tirade. Holden can't quite recall how he got possession of Davis's bat more than a half century ago, but it stayed with him no matter how many times he moved. "I knew a lot of people inside the Dodgers," Holden said. "I sold programs at Dodger Stadium. I was always at the stadium. We used to hang out after the games with Dodger players, hanging out in the parking lot, Lot 5. That was a close-knit group. Well, someone got word that Willie was my favorite Dodger, and somehow I got the bat. I made connections with him long after his playing days at the Santa Anita racetrack when they named a race after him. I kept that bat all those years. I used to practice my golf swing with it, put weighted donuts on it to build my arm strength. It's been my steady companion most of my broadcast career. I love the bat. But now, well, it's time for Eric to have it." Next topic, D-backs disaster. The Arizona Diamondbacks continue to be snake bit when it comes to signing free agent starters, and you wonder how hesitant they will be to ever again swim in the deep free agent waters for starting pitchers. They wanted to keep up with the Dodgers when they signed former Cy Young pitcher Corbin Burns to a franchise-record six-year, $210 million contract in December, only for Burns to need Tommy John surgery. It ends this season and maybe 2026 too. It's just the latest calamity for the Diamondbacks. Their last four marquee signings, Corbin Burns, 6 years, $210 million, 11 starts, 3-2, 2.66 ERA. Jordan Montgomery, 2 years, $47.5 million, 21 starts, 8-7 records, 6.23 ERA. Eduardo Rodriguez, 4 years, $80 million, 19 starts, a 4-7 record with a 5.99 ERA. And then Madison Bumgarner, who was signed in 2024, 5 years, 85 mil, 69 starts, 15-32 with a 5.23 ERA. Montgomery underwent Tommy John surgery this spring, and Rodriguez is 1-3 with a 7.05 ERA this season. Burns' injury all but assures he'll remain in Arizona for the final 4 years and $140 million of his contract instead of exercising his opt-out clause after the 2026 season. It also means the Diamondbacks have to re-sign either Zach Gallen or Merrill Kelly, who are free agents at the season's conclusion, if they plan to remain competitive. Next topic, can you spare some runs? Since the Pirates won't trade ace Paul Skeens, can he at least file a lawsuit against his employer for failure to provide run support? Skeens, who's 4-6 with a 1.88 ERA, has allowed only 19 earned runs in 14 starts this year. But the Pirates have somehow lost 8 of those games. In his last 6 starts, he is yielding a 0.84 ERA and has just 1 victory. Skeens is the first pitcher to lose twice in a single season while allowing no more than 1 run or walk with 8 or more strikeouts in 8 innings since Pedro Martinez in 2000, and only the third in the last 111 years. Incredibly, he still has yet to give up more than 6 hits in any of his 37 career starts with a 1.93 ERA, but has only 15 victories while the Pirates have gone 21-16. Unfortunately, Skeens told a reporter after his start on June 3rd, "It's baseball, and unfortunately, nothing may change the next 4.5 years he remains under the Pirates' control." Now, let's go around the base paths. Despite Atlanta's frustrating season, in which it's in danger of missing the postseason for the first time since 2017, manager Brian Snitker's job appears to be safe for the remainder of the season. He has led Atlanta to 7 consecutive postseasons and a World Series championship. Snitker's contract expires after this year, when he's expected to retire as manager and then move into a special assistant role. Snitker, who has spent 49 years with the organization, deserves to be wildly cheered when he's introduced during the All-Star game during those pregame introductions in Atlanta on Dave Roberts' NL coaching staff. There's a tremendous amount of frustration in Texas these days with the Rangers' struggling offense. Future Hall of Fame manager Bruce Bochy is in the last year of his contract and also is considering walking away after the season. If he retires, former manager of the Marlins, Skip Schumaker, is the favorite to be his replacement. The Boston Red Sox may be playing sloppy and mediocre baseball, but manager Alex Cora's job is safe. The Phillies, Mariners, Cubs, Padres are expected to be the most aggressive teams at the trade deadline. The Phillies will be looking for a center fielder and bullpen help. The Mariners are once again desperate for offense. The Cubs are seeking a frontline starter and relievers, and the Padres are needing a left fielder. No matter where Atlanta is at this time, at the trade deadline, that is, the team isn't expected to be a seller, with the possible exception of DH Marcell Ozuna, who's a free agent after the season. Atlanta still has a fabulous young nucleus, Cy Young winner Chris Sale back for another season, a healthy Spencer Strider, and MVP Ronald Acuna Jr. a year removed from his ACL surgery. Just when the Buzzards started hovering over the Orioles, hoping to grab starters Zach Eflin and Tomoyuki Sugano, closer Felix Bautista and center fielder Cedric Mullins, Baltimore pulled off a 6-game winning streak. The talented young offense could keep the Orioles in the American League wildcard race. Scouts say the talent in this year's amateur draft is down, particularly at the college level, but the 2026 draft has a chance to be phenomenal. The White Sox, who had a chance to trade center fielder Luis Robert for prospects last winter, badly need him to start performing or they could be stuck with him in his $15 million contract for the rest of the season. He has two $20 million club options that certainly won't be picked up unless he has a magical second half. MLB officials are optimistic that the roof will be repaired at Tropicana Field at the tune of about $56 million in time for the Rays to open the 2026 season, where they will remain at least through 2028. After trading All-Star outfielder Kyle Tucker and allowing Gold Glove third baseman Alex Bregman to walk, the Astros are back in first place and could be the team to beat in the AL West. The Tucker trade has worked out quite nicely for both sides. While Tucker is hitting .278 with 12 home runs and 40 RBI for the Cubs, third baseman Isaac Paredes is hitting .246 with 14 homers and 38 RBIs, and rookie outfielder Cam Smith is hitting .245 with 3 homers and 20 RBIs for the Astros. White Sox owner Jerry Reinsdorf, now 89, erased all of the speculation that the White Sox would be up for sale anytime soon, but he does have a succession plan in place beginning in 2029 or perhaps even 2034 when he will turn 98. Reinsdorf, who's been hounded by minority owner Jerry Ishbia for years to sell controlling interest of the club, finally agreed to potentially sell it to him beginning in 2029, but not a single day earlier. If Reinsdorf or his family still own the team in 2034, Ishbia has the right to purchase the club without Reinsdorf approval. In exchange, Ishbia is contributing capital this year and in 2026. The plan was put into place months ago, as The Athletic's John Greenberg reported, but was not announced until the final day of the owners' meeting on June 5th. The Chicago Bulls, also owned by Reinsdorf, will remain in the family, where his son Michael is president and chief operating officer. Ever so quietly, four of the five players who were suspended a year ago for gambling on baseball were reinstated this week. Tucupita Marcano, who bet on games in which he was playing, still is banned for life. The other four, left-hand pitcher Andrew Salfrank of the Diamondbacks and right-hand pitcher Michael Kelly of the Athletics, both rejoined their teams, with Kelly immediately joining the A's bullpen and Salfrank sent to the D-backs minor league complex. Left-hand pitcher Jay Groom of the San Diego Padres and infielder Jose Rodriguez of the Philadelphia Phillies were immediately non-tendered. The majority of players, managers, and coaches aren't in favor of having the automatic ball strike or ABS challenge system put into place for the 26th season and hope to wait at least another year. But Commissioner Rob Manfred said he hopes it's implemented next season. The competition committee consists of 11 people, 6 major league officials, 4 player reps, and 1 umpire. So even if the players all vote against it as expected, it could still pass if the league officials all approve. The Pirates already are drawing interest in versatile infielder Isaiah Kiner-Falefa. The Miami Marlins actually lost money this past week just staffing baseball games at their ballpark against the Rockies. Their total paid attendance for the three-game series was 19,768. Hall of Fame pitcher Randy Johnson told the Seattle Mariners that he'd be honored to have his jersey, number 51, retired, but only if it occurs next season, so that it doesn't interfere with Ichiro Suzuki's Hall of Fame celebration this year. He also wanted to remind the Mariner fans that he did not leave Seattle of his own volition, but was traded to Houston in July of 98. He signed a four-year, $52 million contract with the D-backs that offseason, and then won four consecutive Cy Young Awards and a World Series. It's considered perhaps the greatest return on a multi-year contract in free agent history. I was traded, Johnson said. I didn't walk away. I think that is something I hear from the fans still occasionally. Eyewear companies should be beating down Dodgers third baseman Max Muncy's door for advertisements. Muncy was hitting 180 with no homers, four RBI, and a 5.31 OPS in the first 21 games, rather that's 28 games of this season, before he tried wearing glasses. Since the glasses, he was hitting 278 with nine homers, 31 RBI, and a 9.59 OPS. New York Yankees reliever Mark Leiter Jr. can't stop raving about the impact Aaron Judge has had on him and everyone in the Yankees clubhouse. He's unbelievable, Leiter said. He's the best player on the planet, but he's even a better person. You already know how good he is as a player, but he blows you away what kind of person he is, what kind of leader he is, and he makes every single guy in the room feel good. Pretty special human being. It's an honor to be his teammate, to be honest with you. Does any bullpen have more fun than that of the Minnesota Twins? When they arrive, according to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, they pull out cans of Red Bull, gather around in a circle, drop to one knee with bullpen catcher Frank Nigro, then pouring a shot of Red Bull into their mouths. Nigro proceeds by throwing empty cans against the wall before a fiery speech. How historic was the D-backs' 11-10 victory last week over Atlanta after trailing 10-4 entering the ninth inning? It was the first time Atlanta lost a game when leading by six or more runs after eight innings since July 17, 1973, spanning 766 games. And it was the first time Arizona had a comeback of six or more runs in the ninth in franchise history, having gone 0-419. Boston Red Sox starting pitcher Walker Buehler, who signed a one-year, $21 million contract, realizes that he has hardly lived up to expectations with his 4-4 record and a 5.18 ERA in 10 starts. This organization put a lot of faith in me this offseason, Buehler told reporters after lasting just two innings in his last start, and I've been, expletive, embarrassing for us. Then again, how do you think fellow Red Sox starter Lucas Giolito feels? He signed a two-year, $37 million deal after the 23 season, missed all of last season after elbow surgery, and now is 1-1 with a 6.42 ERA, pitching just 32 and two-thirds innings in seven starts. Angel starter Clyde Wright, who began coaching Kyle Hendricks when he was 12 years old, was at Angel Stadium to congratulate Hendricks on winning his 100th career game June 6th, matching Wright. I told him it only took 23 years after our first lesson, Hendricks told reporters. The Dodgers have become a traveling secretary's worst nightmare this season, much less manager Dave Roberts. They have made 22 transactions through the first week of June and have already employed 13 different starting pitchers. They've had 20 pitchers go on the injured list and still have 15 on it. Their bullpen leads the majors in innings pitched at 278, while their starters have thrown the second fewest innings. Not ideal, Roberts says. The Yankees, who are pulling away in the AL East, soon are expected to have slugger Giancarlo Stanton back for the first time this season. Stanton is scheduled to undergo a rehab assignment next week. No one is winning at small ball more than the San Diego Padres. They have won an MLB leading 23 games this season when scoring no more than two runs, with 12 shutout victories. Seattle Mariners catcher Cal Raleigh, who has an MLB leading 26 home runs, also has become the first to volunteer for this year's Home Run Derby in Atlanta. Raleigh is more than halfway to Kansas City Royals catcher Salvador Perez's record for homers by a catcher with 48 in 2021. Don't look now, but here come those homeless Tampa Bay Rays once again. They entered the week with a 14-4 record since May 20th. They had held opponents to four or fewer runs in all but one of those games. If the season ended at press time, they would be in the postseason, but with no idea where they'd play their home games. Max Fried is doing his best Ron Guidry impersonation since joining the Yankees. He's 8-1 with a 1.78 ERA in 13 starts this season, and 21-3 with a 1.67 ERA in 30 career starts against the American League. In Guidry's first 13 starts of the 78 season, he was 10-0 with 1.57 ERA, finishing the season with a 25-3 record and a 1.74 ERA. Everyone is telling Atlanta ace Spencer Strider that he needs to be patient just five starts into his return after undergoing elbow surgery 14 months ago. Sorry, but Strider at 0-5 with a 5.40 ERA refuses to listen. "I don't have the ability to be patient, honestly," he told reporters. "We've got to win games, and when it's my turn to pitch, I've got to give us a chance to win. If I can't do that, then I don't know what value I'm providing, besides reps." Remember when Phillies starter Jesus Luzardo was cruising along with a 5-0 record and a 2.25 ERA in his first 11 starts, giving up just 19 runs? Well, he'd given up 20 earned runs in his last two starts alone, recording just 17 outs. It's the most runs given up in back-to-back starts by a Phillies pitcher since Bill Hubbell in 1922. Finally, veteran reliever Craig Kimbrell's return to Atlanta lasted all of one game. Now let's run a couple of stories about the NBA playoffs. Here's a story about the Pacers. It's referred to as Built on Overlooked Players. It's by Dustin Doparak from the Indianapolis Star. Miles Turner has said many times in the past, one of the things he likes most about this Pacers team is none of his teammates have had a clear path to stardom. Most of them have been doubted, some even given up on, and they all operate with the level of motivation that comes from feeling like you always have something to prove. "We thrive off of it," Turner said. "It definitely drives us, going through adversity and whatnot. I personally wouldn't have it any other way." Adversity is hit at different places and in different ways for each of the Pacers' key pieces, but all of them had reason to believe being in this NBA Finals in the roles they're in would be out of their reach. All-star point guard Tyrese Halliburton often jokes he was a zero-star recruit in high school, as he didn't get high major offers until the summer before his senior year of high school, with college scared off by the skinny frame and funky-looking jump shot. Even after proving so many doubters wrong and earning all-NBA honors in back-to-back seasons, he was still named the NBA's most overrated player in an anonymous poll of the players run by The Athletic. Just 13 of 90 players who answered that question picked Halliburton, but it was still the most frequently named answer. All-star forward Pascal Siakam grew up in Cameroon and never played basketball at any serious level until he graduated seminary school at 18 years old. And he's still motivated by a sense he's catching up to players who have been involved in the sport since they were toddlers. Doing everything, Aaron Nesmith was a bit of a late bloomer in high school, and after being taken with a number 14 pick, that is, in the 2020 draft, he was buried on Boston's wing depth chart behind Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown before the Celtics traded him away in the deal that brought them Malcolm Brogdon. Ace defender Andrew Nembhard entered the league as a second-round pick, and Turner spent much of a two-year period with the Pacers hearing his name in so many trade rumors he started openly predicting a deal. Veteran backup point guard, T.J. McConnell, caught on in the league and has now played 10 years, despite being very undersized by NBA standards, and undrafted. Forward Obi Toppin has found a place with the Pacers after being stuck on a bench with the Knicks for 3 years. Benedict Mathurin battled tough times growing up in Montreal that included the loss of his older brother. Ben Shepherd barely registered as a high school recruit and played his college basketball at mid-major Belmont. Big men Thomas Bryant and Tony Bradley thought their careers might be finished after the Pacers picked them up over the course of this season, with Bryant stuck on Miami's bench and Bradley having been stuck in the G League for more than a year. And their head coach has been doubted on more than one occasion. Rick Carlisle was an assistant coach for Larry Bird on the last Pacers team that made the finals, and he had hoped to be the head coach when Bird left. But the Pacers instead went with Isaiah Thomas. In his first head coaching job, he rebuilt the Pistons into a playoff team and was named NBA Coach of the Year, but then was fired after just two seasons. The Pistons then hired Larry Brown, who got to pick up where Carlisle left off and ended up leading Detroit to a 2003-2004 NBA title. "We've all been doubted at some point in time of our lives," said Carlisle. "You look in the mirror, you got to face the doubts, and you decide, how are you going to go forward? Are you going to fight through and find a way? Or are you just going to find an excuse? Our team is a bunch of guys who have found a way in a lot of different situations." That shared experiences have a lot to do with the Pacers' cohesion. That's part of what makes this team unselfish. They see themselves in each other and recognize the way their teammates have earned their way into the league. They celebrate each other's victories, so they're happy to share the basketball, communicate on defense, and generally lift each other up. Buying into the collective goals has helped them turn what was a 25-win team in 21-22 to a 47-win team last year and a 50-win team this year, with last year's Eastern Conference Finals run turning into this year's trip to the finals. These Pacers are historically used to being underdogs, so the fact that they're not favored in this series against the Thunder doesn't bother them in the slightest. The Pacers have been underdogs in almost every playoff series they've been involved in, including the Eastern Conference semifinals and finals, in which they took down the Cavs and Knicks, respectively. It bothers them little that the Thunder, who have won 68 games this year, are minus 700 favorites to win this series. "It's rang true for most of our whole careers," Halliburton said. "This is just another stepping stone to it. We're all doubted in this series. There was not expectations for us to get here externally, obviously, so we just have to approach it the right way, approach it the way we've approached every game, the way we approach every day. No one is expecting us to win except for the guys in this locker room, we believe. I think that's the exciting part about it. When you get to prove people wrong, it's exciting." Of course, they also know that as much as the Thunder are the favorites in this series, they have plenty of players who have been doubted as well. Their MVP, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, was traded to the Thunder from the Clippers in his rookie year in the Paul George trade. Their ace defender, Lugans Dort, was undrafted out of Arizona State. Their second leading scorer, Jalen Williams, played his college ball at Santa Clara. Their other ace defender, Alex Caruso, spent a year in the G League after college before he caught on with any NBA team and spent his first two seasons on a two-way contract. Among the coaches who admittedly doubted Caruso was Rick Carlisle, although Caruso now has an NBA title and an all-defensive team nod to his name. "We had Alex Caruso in a free agent camp in Dallas in 2015, well, probably 16, and passed on bringing him into summer league," Carlisle said. "They have great stories, too. I think that makes it a compelling matchup." And next, a story about the Thunder by Joel Lorenzi with the Oklahoman. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander brushes past the mention of legacy as easily as he would a defender. His name being slotted next to history's greatest guards doesn't make him squirm, but balk. Evoke Allen Iverson, and his heart warms while the hairs on his arms stand up. Mention Dwayne Wade, and he'll express inferiority. Connect him to Kobe Bryant, his childhood idol, and he'll pivot. Reference Michael Jordan, and he'll cut you off. Before this magical MVP-winning NBA Finals clinching run, Gilgeous Alexander, who's been linked to those names aesthetically and through his rise for several seasons, would disconnect the dots. Not until he wins the way they did, in June, with history on the line. Oklahoma City Thunder general manager Sam Presti handed Gilgeous Alexander his sharpest tools yet last summer. That he'd even become the centerpiece of a championship build was flattering then. It's a kid dream, SGA said during training camp. No knock on anybody that's not, like, a star player, but growing up, you watch Kobe Bryant, cornerstone of the Lakers franchise. You watch LeBron James, cornerstone of the Cleveland franchise. You watch Allen Iverson, cornerstone of Philly's franchise. Like, those are the guys that are butting in your face when you watch the game of basketball. And the guys that you go out there and try to emulate and go up there and inspire you to play the game. And indirectly, Presti has given me that opportunity to go be that guy. SGA is well past flattery. His dominance has oozed throughout this season like cement, on the verge of solidifying one of the greatest individual seasons ever, should he lead the Thunder to its first ever title over the Pacers. A win over these Pacers and a potential Finals MVP would lock him into elite company, whether he accepts it or not. Only three players in NBA history have won the scoring title, the league MVP, and Finals MVP in a single season: Shaquille O'Neal, Michael Jordan, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. In Oklahoma City, Gilgeous Alexander would be immortalized, bigger than murals or statues, banners or buildings. Devon Tower wouldn't stand nearly as tall as him. This city watched Kevin Durant rip away hope in one summer. 9 years later, he can't so much as get a Christmas card in this town. It regretfully parted with Russell Westbrook, the only son who truly embraced it to the end, to start anew. But SGA, he was traded and basically raised here, given a blank canvas to become a blue-chip prospect. Asked about his willingness to bolt down when entering 20-something win seasons, he's hatched into a superstar, potentially the league's first $80 million man. Seven of Durant's All-Star appearances were with the Thunder. Five of his first-team All-NBA selections came in Oklahoma City, with another second-team nod on the way out. All four of his scoring titles were won in Oklahoma City. This city watched the metamorphosis, the redefining of what bucket-getters looked like. Russell Westbrook had nine All-Star appearances, all with the Thunder, as were his couple of All-NBA first-team spots with another handful of second-team selections. He bottled up at-rim blasts for OKC's enjoyment. They broadened the imagination of a city that once seemed fortunate to have NBA basketball at all. A third superstar later, it might just be deserving. And this one threatens to do what those before him could never do: bring the franchise its first championship. Inside one of the most decorated guard seasons ever, Gilgeous Alexander has inevitably been tied to them. For all the pointed comments about the baby faces and often carded members of his roster, this franchise somehow remains even younger. Unable to buy a lottery ticket, much less a drink. Age restrictions on an NBA title haven't been decided yet. But there is SGA, 26, approaching his prime. The system, the foundation, wielding the power of the Thunder's best shot yet in the same hands that put perfect spin on mid-range jumpers and between-the-leg dribbles nightly. Meticulous digits that have become accustomed to hoisting hardware in recent weeks, just as they have to slicing defenses. He's done it in ways seemingly dissimilar to his predecessors, too. What you need in these ebbs and flows of the regular season and in this environment with the social media and everything, Presti said in his postseason availability last May, you need to have great emotional leadership within your team. I think we have that with him. Gilgeous Alexander honed those emotions as a teenager. He lashed out when basketball didn't go his way. He'd throw the ball. His moods would swing. Those emotions never quite vanished. They no longer feed on him, though. He feeds on them. He had to understand how to lead in his own stale-faced way, toting his lack of expression like a samurai. I just understand not to let it show and kind of weaponize it for myself, SGA said. Showing that gives your opponent a weapon as well. The more that I can be even-keeled through whatever's going on, the less they know what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. When he'd like you to know what he feels, he's expressive. Like his smile through the taunts of a Denver crowd facing a 2-1 deficit in the West semifinals. Like his tears when speaking about his wife during his MVP speech. Even in his responses, which often shift from appreciation to dismissal when he's linked to greats. Perhaps SGA hasn't looked at his ceiling fan, tracing his path, considering his legacy next to those of his idols. But he did spend some time thinking about his last chance at this moment, which died prematurely by his hand. The moment I stepped off the court, Gilgeous Alexander said, the morning after the Thunder's second-round loss to the Mavericks last May, it felt like, well, we're here. We lost. We lost for a reason. And all you can do is learn and get better from that. That's how you ultimately get to where you want to go and where you want to be. It would be great to win a championship this year. It would be great to achieve all our goals. But more often than not, you don't get them when you want them. You get them when you deserve them. If this season speaks to what Gilgeous Alexander deserves, then these next couple of weeks could get gluttonous. He's come for it all. Oklahoma City's Mount Rushmore? Gilgeous Alexander might be adjusting the reins for an ever larger climb. And that concludes our reading of the sports news for this week. I thank you for your listening. Once again, this is Kent Batty, a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a good day. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org by left-clicking on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.